As the official hostess of Her Britannic Majesty's Consul General to the Sudan, Rebecca was responsible for the running of the palace household. This evening, under her supervision, the servants had laid the dinner table on the terrace that overlooked the Blue Nile, so that David's guests might enjoy the breeze off the river. At sunset, the servants would light braziers of eucalyptus branches and leaves. The smoke would keep the mosquitoes at bay. The entertainment would be provided with the compliments of General Gordon. Every evening the military band played, and there was a fireworks display. General Gordon intended the show to take the minds of Khartoum's population off the rigours and hardships of the siege. Rebecca had planned a splendid table. The consular silver and glassware had been polished to dazzling brilliance, and the linen bleached white as an angel's wing. Unfortunately, the meal would not be of comparable quality. They would start with a soup of blackjack weeds and rose hips from the ruins of the palace garden. This would be followed by a pâté of boiled palm tree pith and stone-ground durra. But the pièce de résistance was supreme of pelican. Most evenings David took his station on the terrace above the river with one of his Purdy shotguns at the ready, and waited for the flights of waterfowl to pass overhead as they flew into their roosts. Behind him the twins waited with the other guns. Such a matching trio of firearms was known as a garnish of guns. David believed that any woman who lived in Africa, that continent of wild animals and wilder men, should be competent in the use of firearms. Under his tutelage, Rebecca was already an expert pistol shot. At 10 paces, she was usually capable, with 6 shots from the heavy Webley revolver, of knocking at least 5 empty bully beef cans off the stone wall at the bottom of the terrace to send them spinning out across the waters of the Nile. The twins were still too small to withstand the recoil of a Webley or Purdy, so he had trained them to serve the spare shotguns until they had become as quick and dexterous as a professional loader on a Yorkshire grouse moor. The moment her father had fired both barrels, Amber snatched the empty gun from him, and at almost the same instant Saffron thrust the second into his hands. While he picked his birds and fired again, the girls reloaded the empty weapon and were ready to serve him with it as soon as he reached for it. Between them, they could keep up an impressive rate of fire. David was a celebrated shot and seldom wasted a cartridge. While the girls squealed encouragement, he might on occasion bring down 5 or 6 birds in quick succession from a flight of teal speeding high overhead. In the first weeks of the siege, wild duck had regularly come within range of the terrace. Teal, shovelers, and more exotic species such as Egyptian geese and gargeni, all of which had provided important additions to the palace larder. But the surviving duck learnt quickly, and now the flocks habitually gave the terrace a wide berth. It was only the more stupid and less palatable birds that could still be brought to table by David's marksmanship. A brace of heavily billed pelicans were his most recent victims. The accompanying dish Rebecca planned to serve was the boiled leaves and stems of the sacred Egyptian water lily. When he had recommended this plant to her, Ryder Courtney had told her that its botanical name was Nymphaea alba. He had a vast fund of knowledge of all the natural world. She used the lovely blue blossoms as a salad. Their peppery flavour helped to disguise the pervading, fishy taste of pelican flesh. These plants grew in the narrow canal that cut off the city from the mainland. At this season the water in the canal was waist-deep, but in the low Nile period it dried out. General Gordon had set his troops to widening and deepening the canal into a moat to bolster the city's fortifications, and much to Rebecca's annoyance, they were destroying the source of this nutritious delicacy in the process. The consular cellars were almost bare, except for a single case of Krug champagne that David was saving to celebrate the arrival of the relief force from the south. However, when Ryder Courtney sent Bakshit to the consulate to accept the dinner invitation, he also sent 3 calabash gourds of Tej, the powerful native honey beer, which tasted like poor quality cider. Rebecca intended serving it in crystal claret decanters to give it an importance it did not normally warrant. Now she was putting the finishing touches to the dinner arrangements, and the table's floral decoration of oleander from the neglected gardens. The guests would start arriving in an hour, and her father had not yet returned from his daily meeting with General Gordon. She was a little worried that David might be late and spoil her evening. However, she was secretly relieved that General Gordon had refused the invitation. He was a great and saintly man, a hero of the Empire, but scornful of the social graces. His conversation was pious and arcane, and his sense of humour, to be charitable, was impaired, if not totally lacking. At that moment she heard her father's familiar tread reverberating down the cloisters, and his voice raised as he summoned one of the servants. She ran to greet him as he stepped out onto the terrace. He returned her embrace in a distracted, perfunctory manner. She stepped back and studied his face. "Father, what is it?" "We are to leave the city tomorrow night. General Gordon has ordered all British, French and Austrian citizens to be evacuated at once."
"Does that mean you will come with us, Daddy?"
These days she seldom used the childish term of endearment. "It does indeed."
"How are we to travel?"
"Gordon has commandeered Ryder Courtney's steamer and barges. He has ordered him downriver with all of us on board. I tried to argue with him, but to no avail. The man is intractable and cannot be moved from his chosen path." Then David grinned, seized her round the waist, and spun her into a waltz. "To tell the truth, I'm vastly relieved that the decision has been taken out of my hands and that you and the twins will be conveyed to safety." An hour later, David and Rebecca stood under the candelabrum in the reception lobby to greet their guests, who were almost entirely male. Months before, nearly all the white women had been evacuated north to the Delta aboard General Gordon's tinpot steamers. Now those vessels were stranded far south at Matema, awaiting the arrival of a relief force. Rebecca and the twins were among the few European females who remained in the city. The twins stood demurely behind their father. They had prevailed on their elder sister to allow them to be there when Ryder arrived and to watch the fireworks with him before Nazira, their nurse, took them to the nursery. Nazira had been Rebecca's nurse too and was a beloved member of the Benbrook household. She stood close behind the twins now, ready to spring into action at the first stroke of nine. Much to the twins' disappointment, Ryder Courtney was last to arrive, but when he did, they giggled and whispered together. "He's so handsome," said Saffron, and did her swooning act. Nazira pinched her and whispered in Arabic, "Even if you are never to be a lady, you must learn to behave like one, Safi." "I have never seen him in full fig before," Amber agreed with her twin. Ryder wore one of the new dinner jackets that the Prince of Wales had recently made fashionable. He had watered satin lapels and was nipped in at the waist. He had had it copied from a picture in the London Illustrated News by an Armenian tailor in Cairo and carried it off with a casual elegance far from his rumpled workaday moleskins. He was freshly shaven and his hair shone in the candlelight.
"And look, he has brought us presents."
Amber had seen the telltale bulge in his breast pocket. She had a woman's eye for such details. Ryder shook hands with David and bowed to Rebecca. He refrained from kissing her hand in the Frenchified gesture that many members of the diplomatic corps who had arrived before him had affected. Then he winked at the twins, who covered their mouths to suppress giggles as they dropped him a curtsy in return. "May I have the honour of escorting you two beautiful ladies to the terrace?" He bowed.
"Oui, oui, monsieur,"
said Saffron grandly, which was almost too much for Amber's self-control. Ryder took one on each arm, stooping a little so that they could reach, and led them out through the French windows. One of the servants in a white robe and blue turban brought them glasses of lemonade, made from a few remaining fruits on the trees in the orchard, and Ryder presented the twins with their gifts, necklaces of ivory beads carved in the shape of tiny animals, lions, monkeys, and giraffes. He fastened the clasps at the backs of their necks. They were enchanted. Almost on cue, the military band down on the Medan, beside the old slave market, began to play. The distance muted the sound to a pleasing volume, and the musicians succeeded in embellishing the familiar repertoire of polkas, waltzes, and marching tunes of the British Army with beguiling Oriental cadences.
"Sing for us, Ryder! Oh, please do!"
Amber begged, and when he laughed and shook his head, she appealed to her father.
"Please make him sing, Daddy!"
"My daughter is right, Mr. Courtney. A voice would add immeasurably to the pleasure of the occasion. Ryder sang unself-consciously, and soon had them all tapping their feet or clapping in time to the music. Those who fancied their own vocal prowess joined in with the chorus of Over the Sea to Sky. Then the firework display began, General Gordon's nightly treat. The sky cascaded with sheets of blue, green and red sparks from the ship's signal rockets, and the watchers oohed and aahed in wonder. Over on the far bank of the Nile, the Dervish gunner, whom David had dubbed the Bedlam Bedouin, fired a few shrapnel shells at the point from where he guessed the rockets were being sent off. As usual, his aim was awry, and nobody sought shelter. Instead, everyone booed his efforts with gusto. Then the twins were led away, protesting vainly, to the nursery, and the company was summoned to the table by one of the robed Arab footmen tapping a finger drum. Everyone was in fine appetite. If not yet starving, they were at least halfway there. The portions were minuscule, barely a mouthful each, but Herr Schiffer, the Austrian consul, declared the blackjack weed soup to be excellent, the palm pith pâté nourishing, and the roast pelican quite extraordinary. Rebecca convinced herself that this was meant as a compliment. As the meal drew to a close, Ryder Courtney did something to confirm his status as the hero of the evening. He clapped his hands, and Bakshit, his bosun, came out onto the terrace grinning like a gargoyle and carrying a silver tray on which reposed a cut-glass bottle of VSOP Hein cognac and a cedarwood box of Cuban cigars. With their glasses charged and the cigars drawing until the tips glowed, the men were transported into an expansive mood. The conversation was diverting, until Monsieur Leblanc joined in. "I wonder that Chinese Gordon refused such fine entertainment," he giggled in a girlish, irritating manner. "Surely it is not possible to save the mighty British Empire 24 hours of every day? Even Hercules had to rest from his labours." Leblanc was head of the Belgian delegation sent by King Leopold to initiate diplomatic contact with the Mahdi. So far his efforts had not been crowned by success, and he had ended up a captive in the city like the rest of them. The Englishman at the table looked upon him pityingly. However, as he was a foreigner and knew no better, he was excused the solecism. "The general refused to attend a banquet while the populace was starving," Rebecca rose to Gordon's defence. "I think that was very noble-minded of him." Then she hurried on modestly, "Not that I claim my humble offering as a great banquet." Following her example, David initiated a eulogy to the general's inflexible character and his marvellous achievements. Ryder Courtney was still smarting from Gordon's last demonstration of his adamantine character and did not join in the chorus of praise. "He wields an almost messianic power over his men," David told them earnestly. "They will follow him anywhere, and if they don't, he will drag them by their pigtails, as he did with his ever-victorious army in China, or kick their backsides black and blue, as he does to the Egyptian riff-raff with which he is forced to defend the city at the moment."
"Your language, Daddy," Rebecca chided him primly.
"I'm sorry, my darling, but it's true. He is completely fearless. Alone, mounted on a camel and in full dress uniform, he rode into that murderous rogue Suleiman's encamped army of rebels and harangued them. Instead of murdering him out of hand, Suleiman abandoned the rebellion and went home. He did the same with the Zulus in South Africa. When he walked alone among their warlike impis and turned his extraordinary eyes upon them, they worshipped him as a god. At that, he thrashed their induna for blasphemy." Another spoke up. "Kings and potentates of many nations have competed to secure his services. The Emperor of China, King Leopold of the Belgians, the Khedive of Egypt, and the Premier of the Cape Colony. He is a man of God before he is a warrior. He scorns the clamour of men, and before he makes any fateful decision, he inquires in solitary prayer what his God requires of him." "I wonder that God required him to steal my durra," Ryder thought bitterly. He did not voice the sentiment, but changed the direction of the conversation dramatically. "Is it not remarkable that in many ways the man who faces him now across the Nile shares many characteristics with our gallant general?" A silence followed this remark, which was almost as bad as Leblanc's gaucherie, not at all worthy of a man of the calibre of Ryder Courtney. Even Rebecca was aghast at the idea of comparing the saint with the monster. Yet she noticed that when Ryder spoke, other men listened. Even though he was the youngest man at the table, the others deferred to him, for his fortune and reputation were formidable. He had travelled indefatigably where few men before him had ventured. He had reached the mountains of the moon, and sailed on all of the great lakes of the African interior. He was a friend and confidant of John, the Emperor of Abyssinia. The Muteza of Buganda and the Kamrazi of Bunyoro were his familiars, and had granted him exclusive trading rights in their kingdoms. His Arabic was so fluent that he could debate the Quran with the mullahs in the mosque. He spoke a dozen other more primitive tongues and could bargain with the naked Dinka and the Shilluk. He had hunted and captured every known species of the wild beasts and birds of Equatoria and sold them to the menageries of the kings, emperors, and zoological gardens of Europe. "That is an extraordinary notion, Ryder," David ventured cautiously. "It strikes me that the Mad Mahdi and General Charles Gordon stand at opposite poles. But perhaps you can point out some characteristics they have in common." "First, David, they are both ascetics who praise self-denial and abstain from worldly comforts," Ryder replied easily. "And both are men of God."
"Different gods?" David challenged.
"Oh, no, sir. One and the same God. The God of the Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and all other monotheists, is the same God. It is simply that they worship him in different ways."
David smiled.
"Perhaps we can debate that later. But for now, tell us what else they have in common." "They both believe that God speaks directly to them, and that therefore they are infallible. Once their minds are set, they are unwavering and deaf to argument. Then again, like many great men and beautiful women, they are both betrayed by their belief in the cult of personality. They believe that they are able to carry all before them by the blue of their eyes, or by the gap between their front teeth and their eloquence," Ryder said.
"We know who possesses the blue and compelling eye," David chuckled. "But to whom belongs the gap-toothed grin?"
"To Muhammad Ahmed, the Mahdi, the divinely guided one," said Ryder. "The wedge-shaped gap is called the Falja, and his Ansar consider it a mark of the divine."
"You speak as though you are familiar with him," said Leblanc. "Have you met the man?"
"I have," Ryder confirmed, and they all stared at him, as though he admitted to supping with Satan himself. Rebecca was the first to rouse herself.
"Do tell us, Mr. Courtney, where and when. What is he truly like?"
"I knew him first when he lived in a hole in the bank of Abbas Island, 40 miles up the Blue Nile from where we now sit. Often when I passed the island I would go ashore to sit with him and speak of God and the affairs of men. I could not claim that we were friends, nor would I ever wish to do so. But there was something about him that I found fascinating. I sensed that he was different, and I was always impressed by his piety, his quiet strength and unruffled smile. He is a true patriot, as is General Gordon. Another trait they have in common."
"Enough of General Gordon. We all know his virtues," Rebecca interjected. "Tell us rather of this terrible Mahdi. How can you say he has in him a grain of the same nobility?"
"We all know that the domination of the Sudan by the Khedive in Egypt has been iniquitous and brutal. Behind the magnificent facade of imperial dominion has flourished unspeakable corruption and cruelty. The native population has been subject to greedy and heartless pashas, and an army of occupation 40,000 strong, which was used to collect the extortionate taxes the pashas imposed. Only half went to the Khedive in Cairo, and the rest into the personal coffers of the pashas. The land was ruled by bayonet and kerbash, the vicious hippo hide whip. The effete pashas sitting here in Khartoum delighted in devising the most savage tortures and executions. Villages were razed and their inhabitants slaughtered. Arab and black men alike cowered under the shadow of the hated Turk, but no man dared protest. The Egyptians, while aspiring to civilization, fostered and encouraged the trade in slaves, for that was how the taxes were paid. I have seen such horrors with my own eyes, and I was amazed by the forbearance of the population. I discussed all this with the hermit in his hole in the river bank. We were both young men, although I was by some years the younger. We attempted between us to discover why this situation persisted, for the Arab is a proud man and has not lacked provocation. We decided that two essential elements of revolution were missing, and the first of these was the knowledge of better things. General Charles Gordon, as the governor of the Sudan, provided this. The other missing element was an uniting catalyst among the oppressed. In the fullness of time, Muhammad Ahmed provided this. It was how the new Mahdist nation was born. They were silent until Rebecca spoke again, and hers was a woman's question. The political, religious, and military facets of the Mahdi's history interested her very little. But what is he really like, Mr. Courtney? What of his appearance and his demeanour? How does his voice sound? And tell us more of this strange gap between his teeth. He possesses the same vast charisma as Charles Gordon, another trait they have in common. He is of medium height and slim in stature. He's always dressed in robes of spotless white, even when he lived in the hole in the ground. On his right cheek is a birthmark in the shape of a bird or an angel. This is seen by his disciples and adherents as a touch of the divine. The gap between his teeth rivets your attention when he speaks. He is a compelling orator. His voice is soft and sibilant until his ire is aroused. Then he speaks with the thunder of one of the biblical prophets, but even in anger he smiles. Ryder drew out his gold pocket watch. It lacks only an hour of midnight. I have kept you late. We should all get a good night's rest, for as you have been told, it is my duty, allotted to me by General Gordon, to make certain that none of you here tonight will ever be forced to listen to the voice of Muhammad Ahmed. Remember, please, that you are to be aboard my steamer at the Old City Wharf before midnight tomorrow. It is my intention to sail while it is still too dark for the Dervish gunners to pick us out clearly. Please restrict your luggage to the minimum. With good fortune, we may run clean away from them before they get off a single shot. David smiled. That'll require a certain amount of luck, Mr. Courtney, for the city is crawling with Dervish spies. The Mahdi knows exactly what we're up to, almost before we know it ourselves. Perhaps this time we will be able to outwit him. Ryder half rose and bowed to Rebecca. I apologize if I've overstayed my welcome, Miss Benbrook.
Oh, it's still far too early for you to leave. None of us will sleep yet. Please sit down, Mr. Courtney. You cannot leave us high and dry. Finish the story, for you have intrigued us all.
Ryder made a gesture of resignation and sank down again on his chair. How can I resist your command? But I fear you all know the rest of the story, for it has been often told, and I do not wish to bore you. There were murmurs of protest down the length of the table.
Go on, sir. Miss Benbrook is right. We must hear out your version. It seems that it differs greatly from what we have come to believe.
Ryder Courtney nodded acquiescence and went on.
In our Western societies we pride ourselves in glorious traditions and high moral standards, yet in savage and uneducated peoples ignorance provides its own source of great strength. It engenders in them the overpowering stimulus of fanaticism. Here in the Sudan there were three giant steps on the road to rebellion. The first was the misery of all the native peoples of the country. The second was when they looked about them and recognized that the source of all their ills was the hated Turk, the minions of the Khedive in Cairo. It needed but a single step more before the mighty wave of fanaticism crashed over the land. That was the moment when there arose the man who would become the Mahdi.
Of course, interjected David. The seed had been sown long ago. The Shukri belief that one day, in the time of shame and strife, a second great prophet would be sent by Allah, who would lead the faithful back to God and sustain Islam. Rebecca looked sternly at her father.
It's Mr. Courtney's story, father. Please let him tell it.
The men smiled at her fire, and David looked guilty.
I did not mean to usurp your tale. Pray go on, sir.
But you are right, David. For 100 years the people of the Sudan have always looked in hope to any ascetic who rises to prominence. As this one's fame spread, pilgrims began flocking to Abbas Island. They brought valuable gifts, which Muhammad Ahmed distributed to the poor. They listened to his sermons, and when they left to return to their homes, they took with them the writings of this holy man. His fame spread throughout the Sudan, until it reached the ears of one who had waited eagerly all his life for the coming of the second prophet, Abdullahi. The son of an obscure cleric and the youngest of his four brothers journeyed to Abbas Island in wild expectation. He arrived at last on a saddle-galled donkey, and he recognized instantly the devout young hermit as the true messenger of God. David could not restrain himself longer. Or did he recognize the vehicle that would convey him to power and wealth undreamed? Perhaps that is more accurate, Ryder laughed in accord. But be that as it may, the two men formed a powerful alliance. Soon news reached the ears of Rauf Pasha, the Egyptian governor of Khartoum, that this mad priest was preaching defiance to the Khedive in Cairo. He sent a messenger to Abbas to summon Muhammad Ahmed here to the city to justify himself. The priest listened to the messenger, then stood up and spoke in the voice of a true prophet. By the grace of God and his prophet, I am the master of this land. In God's name I declare jihad, holy war on the Turk. The messenger fled back to his master, and Abdullahi gathered around him a tiny band of ragged wretches, then armed them with sticks and stones. Rauf Pasha sent two companies of his best soldiers by steamer upriver to capture the troublesome priest. He believed in the incentive method of conducting warfare. He promised promotion and a large reward to whichever of his two captains made the arrest. At nightfall, the steamboat captain landed the soldiers on the island, and the two companies, now in competition with each other, marched by separate routes to surround the village in which the priest was reported to be sheltering. In the confusion of the moonless night, the soldiers attacked each other furiously, then fled back to the landing. The terrified steamboat captain refused to let them embark unless they swam out to his boat. Few accepted this offer, for most could not swim, and those who could feared the crocodiles. So the captain abandoned them and sailed back to Khartoum. Muhammad Ahmed and Abdullahi, with their tattered Armelian army, fell upon the demoralized Egyptians and slaughtered them. News of this extraordinary victory spread throughout the land, that men with sticks had routed the hated Turk. Surely it must have been the Mahdi who led them. Knowing that more Egyptian troops would be sent to kill him, the newly self-proclaimed Mahdi began a hegira, very much like the exodus of the one true prophet from Mecca 1,000 years before. However, before the retreat began, he appointed the faithful Abdullahi as his khalifa, the deputy under God. This was in accordance with precedent and prophecy. Soon the retreat became a triumphal progress. The Mahdi was preceded by tales of miracles and prodigious omens. One night a dark shadow obliterated the crescent moon, the symbol of Egypt and the Turk. This message from God on high in the midnight sky was plain for every man in the Sudan to see. When the Mahdi reached a mountain fastness far to the south of Khartoum, which he renamed Jebel Massa in accordance with the prophecy, he deemed himself safe from Rauf Pasha. However, he was still within striking distance of Fashoda. Rashid Bey, the governor of the town, was braver and more enterprising than most Egyptian governors. He marched on Jebel Massa with 1,400 heavily armed troops. But, scornful of this rabble of peasants, he took few precautions. The intrepid Khalifa Abdullahi laid an ambush for him. Rashid Bey marched straight into it, and neither he nor any single one of his men survived the day. They were slaughtered by the ragged, ill-armed Ansar. Ryder's cigar had gone out. He stood up, took a glowing twig from the brazier of eucalyptus branches, and relit it. When it was drawing brightly again, he returned to his chair. Now that Abdullahi had captured rifles and vast military stores, not to mention the treasury of Fashoda, in which was deposited almost £500,000, he had become a formidable force. The Khedive in Cairo ordered that a new army be raised here at Khartoum and gave the command of it to a retired British officer, General Hicks. It was one of the most abysmally inept armies ever to take the field, and Hicks's authority was diluted and countermanded by the bumbling Rauf Pasha, who was already the author of two military disasters. Ryder paused, and as he poured the last of the Hein into his glass, he shook his head sadly. It is almost 2 years to the day that General Hicks marched out of the city, with 7,000 infantry and 500 cavalry. He was supported by mounted artillery, Krupp's guns and Nordenfeldt machine guns. His men were mostly Muslims, and they had heard the legend of the Mahdi. They began to desert before he had covered 5 miles. He clapped 50 men of the Krupp's battery in chains to encourage them to greater valour, but they still deserted and took their manacles with them. Ryder threw back his head and laughed, and although the tale had been terrifying, the sound was so infectious that Rebecca found herself laughing with him. What Hicks did not know, and what he did not believe, even when Lieutenant Penrod Ballantyne, his intelligence officer, warned him, was that by now 40,000 men had flocked to the Mahdi's green flag. One of the emirs who had brought his tribe to join the array was none other than Osman Atalan of the Beja. The men around the table stirred at the mention of that name. It was one to conjure with, for the Beja was the fiercest and most feared of all the fighting Arabs, and Osman Atalan was their most dreaded warlord. On the 3rd of November 1883, Hicks's motley force ran headlong into the army of the Mahdi, and they were cut to pieces by the charges of the Ansar. Hicks himself was mortally wounded as he stood at the head of the last formed square of his troops. When he fell, the square broke, and the Ansar swarmed over it. Penrod Ballantyne, who had warned Hicks of the danger, saw the general empty his revolver into the charging Arabs before his head was sliced off by a swinging broadsword. Ballantyne's own superior officer, Major Adams, was lying shot through both legs, and the Arabs were massacring and mutilating the wounded. Ballantyne sprang to horse and managed to lift Major Adams up behind his saddle. Then he hacked his way out through the attackers and broke clear. He caught up with the Egyptian rearguard, which was by this time in full flight for Khartoum. He was the only surviving European officer, so he took command. He rallied them and led a fighting retreat back into Khartoum. Ballantyne brought back 200 men, including the wounded Major Adams. 200 men of the 7,500 who had marched out with General Hicks. His conduct was the one single ray of light in an otherwise dark day. Thus the Mahdi and his Khalifa became masters of all the Sudan, and they closed in with their victorious 40,000 on this city, bringing with them the captured guns that torment us to this day. And so the populace languishes and starves, or perishes from pestilence and cholera, while awaiting the fate that the Mahdi has in store for Khartoum. There were tears in Rebecca's eyes as Ryder stopped speaking. "He sounds a fine and brave young man, this Penrod Ballantyne. Have you ever met him, Mr. Courtney?" "Ballantyne?" Ryder looked surprised by this abrupt change in the focus of his tale. "Yes, I was here when he rode back from the battlefield." "Tell us more about him, please, sir." Ryder shrugged. "Most of the ladies I have spoken to assure me that they find him dashing and gallant. They are particularly enamoured of his moustache, which is formidable. Perhaps Captain Ballantyne might agree rather too readily with the general feminine opinion of himself?" "I thought you spoke of him as a lieutenant." "In an attempt to garner some tiny grain of glory from that terrible day, the commander of the British troops in Cairo made a great fuss of Ballantyne's role in the battle. It just so happens that Ballantyne is a subaltern in the 10th Hussars, which is Lord Wolsey's old regiment. Wolsey's always ready to give a fellow hussar a leg up, so Ballantyne was uplifted to the rank of a full captain, and if that was not sufficient, he was given the Victoria Cross to boot." "You do not approve of Captain Ballantyne, sir?" Rebecca asked. For the first time, David detected in his daughter's attitude towards Ryder Courtney a definite coolness. He wondered at the rather excessive interest she was evincing towards Ballantyne, who presumably was a stranger to her. when suddenly, with a small shock, he recalled that young Ballantyne had visited the consulate some weeks before Hicks's army had marched away to annihilation at El Obeid. The lad had come to deliver a dispatch from Evelyn Baring, the British consul in Cairo, which had been too sensitive to be sent over the telegraph, even in cipher. Although nothing had been said at the time, he had guessed that Ballantyne was an officer in the intelligence section of Baring's staff, and that his seconding to Hicks's motley army was merely a cover.
"Damn, yes, it's all coming back," David thought.
Rebecca had come into his office while he was engaged with Ballantyne. The two young people had exchanged a few polite words when he introduced them, and Rebecca had left them alone. But later, when he was showing Ballantyne to the door, David had noticed her arranging flowers in the hall. On glancing out of his office window a short time later, he had seen his daughter walking with Ballantyne to the palace gate. Ballantyne had seemed attentive. Now it all fell into place. Perhaps it was not pure chance that Rebecca had been lingering in the hall when Ballantyne emerged from his office. He smiled inwardly at the way his daughter had pretended never to have met Ballantyne when she asked Ryder Courtney his opinion of the man.
So young, but already so much like her mother, David reflected, as devious as a palace full of pashas.
Ryder Courtney was still responding to Rebecca's challenge. "I'm sure that Ballantyne is an authentic hero, and I am indeed impressed by his facial hair. However, I have never detected in him any excess of humility. But then again, I am ambivalent about all military men. When they have finished thrashing the heathen, storming cities and seizing kingdoms, they simply ride away, their sabres and metals clinking. It is left to administrators like your father to try to make some order out of the chaos they have created, and to businessmen like myself to restore prosperity to a shattered population. No, Miss Benbrook, I have no quarrel with Captain Ballantyne, but I am not entirely enamoured of that branch of the state apparatus to which he belongs." Rebecca's eye was cold and her expression severe, as Ryder Courtney stood up again to leave, but this time with greater determination. Rebecca did not attempt to delay his departure any longer.